I'm happy now to welcome to the program Irika Okeke. She is professor of biology at Haverford College, and she's the author of the new book, Divining Without Seeds, The Case for Strengthening Laboratory Medicine in Africa. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So your book examines this vast subject of healthcare in Africa and the reality that there is that it's not enough to have clinics and drugs, but you actually need a lot more tools for diagnosis, like laboratories that do lab tests. Describe some of the common problems that arise from inadequate diagnosis that led you to write this book.
Well, a very important problem is that people who are ill receive a treatment that may not cure them when a cure exists. For example, if someone has a fever, very often in many parts of Africa, a fever is actually malaria. But sometimes a fever can be caused by an infection caused by bacteria or viruses. And in those cases, antimalarials wouldn't work. And so if you have a situation where every patient with a fever is just based on their clinical signs diagnosed as having malaria, you have a situation where people who have other infections aren't receiving the correct treatment because they'll receive treatments for malaria. And also that antimalarials, these drugs that are very valuable for malaria, get overused, and then you have a problem of drug resistance.
So if a person goes in, they don't have malaria, and they're treated for malaria, not only does the condition that they have not get cured, but they've got these drugs in their system that are, what, creating resistant strains, doing harm? What happens?
Yes, they could create resistant strains. In some cases, some of the drugs are harmful. They have side effects. And also, because the patient isn't cured, in addition to remaining sick themselves, they're in a position to transfer this infection to somebody else. And so you increase the number of people who get sick by not treating those who are sick promptly.
Now, you have some of your own experience of that. You went in and you were treated for malaria and didn't have it. Is that correct?
Absolutely. My final year in college, I had a fever that actually lasted several weeks. And in college, I was, you know, at a university that had a health center with access to doctors and a pharmacy. And I went there three times, and each time I was diagnosed as having malaria. I was given antimalarials, and I just didn't get better. And it was until I had a diagnostic test, which was not ordered by any of the doctors, that it was found out that I actually had typhoid fever, which is caused by bacteria. And once that diagnosis was made, I was given, you know, an antibiotic and immediately got better. And this is, you know, a really serious situation that happens to many people, some who don't have as good access to health care. And typhoid fever is the sort of thing that if you have it for a long time, there is a danger of intestinal perforations, which could either kill a patient or could require that patient to need surgery, which is much more expensive than administering a drug if you'd caught it earlier.
What are the most common illnesses? I mean, Africa is a vast continent, but for which people seek out doctors, and some of them are traveling quite long distances from home.
Well, absolutely. Africa is very, very large. Most of what I focus in the book is parts of tropical Africa, which are, you know, close to or around the equator. And in these areas, infectious diseases are a very, very large cause of illness and death. And so many patients who are visiting outpatient clinics, particularly patients who are children, have an infectious disease. And this would include, you know, everything from malaria to a respiratory infection like pneumonia to, you know, a bloodstream infection like typhoid fever. There is, in many of these countries, not all of them, there's a pretty high burden of HIV as well. And so you have all of these infectious diseases, many of which can be treated or even curable with inexpensive drugs if you can be sure of what it is that the patient actually has.
In your case, when you had typhoid fever and it was misdiagnosed as malaria, why, I mean, you had, basically, you had a decent health infrastructure around you. Why were the proper tests not done? Why weren't they part of the normal thing that you do?
There are lots of reasons why tests aren't used very commonly. One of those reasons is that in many cases they just aren't there. But the other reason is that because they're not there in many cases, health professionals get used to working without them. And so even when they're there, they often don't think to order them, essentially. And so, you know, you get used to doing things a certain way, and then you start to cut corners. And this is a very important corner that has been cut time and time again in many health institutions. The other perception is that a diagnostic test takes time. Some of them take, you know, half an hour. Others may take days to deliver a result, whereas a drug is something that you can hand over immediately. And so very often the temptation for the health professional is to hand over something immediately that might work rather than identify something that absolutely will work if there's a little bit of a longer wait.
And then you have a case when there aren't diagnostic tests. Somebody immediately hands out a prescription. The person goes back home, and there's no follow-up. So the doctors and nurses don't even have any feedback about whether their treatments did or did not work.
This is absolutely true. I mean, in many of the places that, you know, I was working in or reading about, we're talking about places where the proportion of doctors and nurses to the rest of the population is so small that most people don't have a personal physician. Most people just go to hospital when they're ill. They consult with whoever's at the front of the line on that day, and there is no follow-up. And it's very unlike, you know, what goes on here in the United States, which is your doctor can say, well, you know, take this. If things don't improve in 2 days, please come back. Many patients incur incredible expenses just to get to a hospital. And so they wouldn't have enough money to be able to come back, or they wouldn't be able to take those extra days off to be able to come back. So it's really important in these parts of Africa to make sure that when a patient appears at the first visit, that you make as precise a diagnosis as possible.
So the way you write about it and the way you're talking about it, it looks like there's a lot of trial and error medicine. Do people, when they don't get better because the diagnosis was incorrect, they stay sick, do they then, I mean, are they already back home, you know, dozens or hundreds of miles away, and then turn around and come back yet again? What happens next if the diagnosis is incorrect?
Well, I mean, the way you characterize it, you know, trial and error medicine is just that. And what happens to a patient who goes to a hospital, ends up unfortunately getting the wrong treatment and going home, a number of things could happen. First of all, the patient could be extremely better and get better by, extremely lucky and get better by themselves. That is one possibility. The other possibility is that the patient will incur that additional expense and come back in the future. And another possibility, again, is that the patient will seek care somewhere else. And most patients in Africa seek care from multiple sources. Some of them are, you know, biomedical clinics and hospitals. Some of them are faith healers. Some of them are traditional practitioners. You have a situation of medical pluralism, which is very, very common. And of course, precisely because in many situations, each practitioner is not always successful. And so in actual fact, but if biomedicine wants to be able to recruit a larger share of the healthcare system, it's important that it's successful many times. And that will ensure that patients will develop trust in biomedicine and be able to actually reap the benefits that biomedicine can offer in terms of diseases that it can cure if it can diagnose them, first of all.
If you have a situation where people are coming from far away, let's say you had the diagnostic laboratories, the tests were administered, not all tests come back instantaneously. Some of them take a couple of days or more to get the results. I would think that just the basic problem of where is the person going to stay, or the mother with her sick child or children.
Absolutely. This is an incredibly important problem for diagnostics in resource-limited parts of the world. The best diagnostics are those that are going to give you a result in a few minutes, and certainly within that day, the patient's visit. Because when you ask the patient to come back for test results, it's just as bad as saying, come back if you don't get better. And there are a few diagnostic tests that can be performed even without a lab in a clinic in a rural center. These are rapid diagnostic tests that can be performed at the point of care. We need to ensure that those tests, when available, are used. That's the first thing. And the second thing, the technology to develop other tests in this kind of format exists. And we need to convince scientists that this is an important area of research for them, to use existing technologies to develop tests for conditions for which the current diagnostic test takes 2, 3, 4 days. This is very, very important to ensure that healthcare is delivered properly in places where healthcare is expensive and scarce.
We're talking to Iruka Okeke about her book, Divining Without Seeds, The Case for Strengthening Laboratory Medicine in Africa. When people turn to traditional healers, what kind of healers are you talking about? I mean, there are certainly must be some good herbalists whose medicine does work. Is that true?
Absolutely. We know just from preliminary tests that have been done that there are certain herbal preparations that are used in traditional medicine in different parts of Africa that have activity against malaria parasites, that have activity against bacteria and so on. And so, you know, using traditional medicine is not necessarily a bad thing. The important thing is that people should be able to choose the best health care for themselves at any given time based on efficacy and not based on the fact that a particular system isn't operating as well as it should be. So, you know, biomedicine, or, you know, if you like, you could call it Western medicine, is designed to, first of all, diagnose a patient, and if it's an infectious disease, to include a laboratory test, and then prescribe a treatment. If it's missing out some of the earlier steps, it's not putting its best foot forward. And in that kind of situation, maybe the patient would actually be better going to a herbal practitioner that is practicing according to the tenets of his own science. And the question as to which is more effective is difficult to answer when many of the traditional preparations haven't been evaluated in controlled studies on one hand, and on the other hand, the controlled studies that support biomedicine assume a certain protocol is followed, and that protocol isn't actually followed in many cases.
It's funny, when I was reading your book and thinking about the kind of problems that you are discussing, that you're writing about, we have maybe some similar problems here, but for different reasons. We have the overprescription of antibiotics here and the tremendous problem of resistant strains. We have people here in the U.S. getting infections in hospitals, as you do in Africa. And we also have the lost art of diagnosis for a number of reasons, but partly because doctors don't get to spend very much time with their patients, and so many of them are so specialized that it's some of the same problems, but I suppose for quite different reasons.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you point out all those problems. All of those problems actually exist worldwide, and including in Africa. And, you know, one of the things I'm writing about is layering on top of these problems that you've just outlined is the additional problem that in cases where a simple point-of-care diagnostic test and a simple prescription based on the result of that test is not done. And so you have a situation where, yes, absolutely, antimicrobials are actually overused, even in Africa where there are not enough of them. But you also have the added layer of the fact that some of that overuse could be avoided if diagnostics were used more, and it's not. So, you know, we do have general problems in healthcare about how healthcare is delivered. And this, you know, what I refer to as diagnostic insufficiency, adds layers to those problems so that the situation is actually much, much worse.
Tell us about the current reality of HIV and AIDS in the parts of Africa that you studied. What about that? Are people being diagnosed? Is there testing? Is there free testing? Is there treatment?
The good news about HIV and AIDS is that things have got a lot better in very recent years. Originally, when, you know, of course, most people alive today can remember a time when we didn't actually know what caused AIDS. We're in a situation now to know that, you know, you have the HIV virus. We have reliable tests for detecting that virus. When those tests initially became available in Europe and America, they weren't available in African countries, including the African countries that had the highest burdens of disease. And this was a problem, because it meant that people who were infected with HIV but had not begun to manifest with, you know, the symptoms of AIDS, just didn't know they were infected, and then they couldn't stop themselves from infecting other people. More recently, testing has become more available, and also more recently, antiretrovirals have become more available. And this is important because one of the things that motivates people to get tested is the knowledge that if you get tested and you are HIV positive, you can receive treatment that will extend your life. And so I think one of the great developments in relatively recently is getting more people access to HIV testing across Africa and access to antiretrovirals when they need that. Having said that, we still have a huge population that that needs HIV testing and can't access it. So it hasn't been rolled out to everybody who needs that kind of help. And additionally, when you do get an HIV diagnosis with a lab test, which can be obtained now in many parts of Africa, you need additional testing if you test positive to ensure that you start antiretrovirals when you're supposed to, and to ensure that if you need to switch those antiretrovirals because the virus that you're carrying is resistant, that switch occurs at the right time. And the tests to do that kind of diagnosis are actually a bit more sophisticated and are much less available across Africa. And this is going to be really important in the coming years because antiretroviral therapy is lifelong treatment. And there is a chance that if it's not monitored carefully, that resistance could arise. And what we don't want to see is resistance strains arising in individual patients and then spreading, because that would mean that the options for antiretroviral therapy will reduce, and also that antiretroviral therapy will become much, much more expensive. And right now, we can't afford to treat all the patients who are sick today or who are infected with HIV today.
What are the rural health clinics, the hospital infrastructures like in the places in Africa that you've studied, and what do they do well?
There's a whole variety of health systems. There's anything from, you know, a very sophisticated hospital that would look exactly like a hospital in the U.S. to a very, very remote rural clinic that probably won't have a doctor, might have a nurse but may not. It might actually have a village health worker. Some of the things that they do well. One very nice example is diarrhea in very young children. This, for several decades, was one of the most important causes of death among children less than 1 year old. And these deaths have dropped significantly because primary health care centers, even remote rural primary health care centers, have been able to educate mothers who have children to use oral rehydration therapy as soon as their children get diarrhea. And what this means is that if a child gets diarrhea and gets oral rehydration therapy at home or at a primary health care center, that child is more likely to survive than a child who doesn't get that therapy and will eventually die of dehydration. This is something that couldn't have been done without those rural clinics that are very, very close to the patient. The patient can get to easily. And another example is immunization. A lot of these clinics are responsible for ensuring that we have not perfect, and we still have room for improvement, but very good immunization coverage of children who live in very, very remote parts of the world.
Why is it that there are, in many places in Africa, including these remote places, doctors and nurses, but not diagnostic tests?
One could make many hypotheses there to explain what happened. One of the reasons is that biomedical health care in many African countries is modeled on the colonial health care systems that were built about 100 years ago to serve expatriates who were working in African countries who had come in from Europe. And typically, these systems included doctors and nurses. They did not include laboratory technicians. In part because it was known that, if anybody had anything, and by anybody I mean the expatriate worker and not the local African resident, if they had anything that was serious, a specimen could be sent back home to their home countries, or the person could be sent back home to their home countries. And so very early on, what was deemed essential in terms of health professionals was doctors and nurses, and then optional was things like laboratory technicians. And the other thing to remember is that these health systems were developing, you know, in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, just as antibiotics were being discovered, and at a time when we didn't understand things like antibiotic resistance. And so we thought that just throwing antibiotics at everything was a great way to deal with disease. We now know that that is not the case, and that using antibiotics very sparingly is the way to avoid drug resistance. But unfortunately, health systems had been developed on that model before we understood how resistance came to be.
We're talking to Iruka Okeke, author of the book Divining Without Seeds, The Case for Strengthening Laboratory Medicine in Africa. What does the title refer to, Divining Without Seeds?
I use an analogy in the book comparing diagnostic methods in biomedicine with indigenous practice in many parts of Africa. So many indigenous practitioners use seeds, are probably the most common thing. Some use bones to throw a pattern when they consult with a patient. And based on the pattern of the seeds, they make a diagnosis, and then based on that pattern, they now prescribe something for the patient. And one of the things I was interested in when I began to compile the case studies I was getting for biomedicine, I was interested in where does this practice of treating people without proper diagnosis come from? Does it come from indigenous medicine? And it's unlikely that it does, because indigenous medicine actually has clear protocols that insist upon diagnosis before treatment, just like biomedicine does, actually. And so seeing people who are practicing biomedicine treating patients without, first of all, going through the necessary steps to get a diagnosis, in my opinion, looked like an indigenous diviner working without bothering to throw his seeds. And that's how the book got that title.
Now, what would be some of the best ways to prevent the most prevalent diseases in Africa, rather than treat them, but to prevent them in the first place?
That's a really good question, Mary Charlotte. I think that, you know, as I mentioned, most of these patients are coming with infectious diseases that are curable. The thing I didn't say is that actually most of the diseases are preventable as well. If everybody in Africa had access to clean, potable water, we would get rid of a large chunk of the diarrheal diseases, we'd get rid of a large chunk of the typhoid fever, and other waterborne diseases that are potentially lethal but preventable if water was clean. Another example is, you know, if everybody slept under an insecticide-treated bed net, a lot less people would get bitten by infected mosquitoes and we would have malaria rates dropping. We know this because now that insecticide-treated bed nets are being given free in some countries, we are actually seeing the rates of infection due to malaria drop pretty quickly. So these are, you know, a couple of examples. More examples would include vaccination. If we can increase access to vaccines, particularly for young children, we could actually reduce the number of people getting vaccine-preventable diseases. If we could increase access to antimalarials for pregnant women, we could reduce the number of women who get severe malaria while they're pregnant, and whose babies are often aborted. So these are just a few examples of actually very relatively inexpensive ways of controlling disease. And these are some of the examples or things like them that actually controlled infectious diseases in North America and Europe, because we had most of the infectious diseases reduced to a very, very low level before antibiotics and other medicines for treating infections were actually discovered.
Is there a relationship between prevention, the kind of prevention you're talking about, and laboratory diagnosis?
There is. I mean, first of all, you want to make sure that you've done everything that you can to prevent infection. But then if somebody does get sick, either because your preventive methods failed at some point, or because, you know, there was just somebody was unlucky or somebody drank water that he shouldn't have drunk, then it's really important to be able to identify ill people quickly and treat them before they can spread their disease to others. That's, in a sense, that is one way of preventing the spread of the infection, not in the individual that came with it originally, but in people that could be infected. The other thing is that, you know, when we design and use preventive tools like vaccines. We need information about who gets the disease, what their risk factors are, and so on. And that kind of infection can only come, that kind of information can only come if we have specific diagnosis for people who are ill so that we know what it is that they actually have and how they might have been infected. And finally, you know, if we are able to actually eradicate some diseases by using excellent and foolproof preventive methods, we're going to need diagnostic tests to determine when we have actually completed eradication. And so diagnostic tests, they do play a greater role in curative medicine than in preventive medicine, but they do have their uses for preventing infection.
Now, you've been talking about laboratory tests, which I guess blood tests, cultures, and so on. What about other kinds of diagnostics? Are there sufficient, for example, X-ray machines and things like that?
There are actually not. You're absolutely right. So one of the first things you want to do when you have a sick patient, if you're a health professional, is actually just to do a clinical exam. You know, a clinical exam will, in some cases, it'll actually give you the diagnosis right away, but in most cases, it'll actually let you know which diagnostic tests are worth ordering, because you're not going to order every test for every patient. So that's really important. And the unfortunate thing for many African health systems is that the people who are best trained at clinical diagnosis are doctors. And doctors are so scarce that many patients don't have access to somebody who would be very, very skilled at a clinical diagnosis. That's one thing. And certainly you need more things like, you know, X-rays and, you know, electronic diagnostics, if you like, for diagnosing particularly many chronic conditions and many cancers, you know, can help with some chest diseases and so on. But what's really interesting when you look at Africa historically and now, you'll be surprised to know that even though X-rays cost a lot more, they are really difficult to maintain, that they're actually more available in some parts of Africa than laboratory diagnostic tests that are cheaper and that are easier to perform without sophisticated equipment. And so, you know, while I would always advocate for better diagnostics for every disease, including things like X-rays and scanning machines and so on, it's important to acknowledge that some of the diagnostic tests for some of the most common diseases are actually very, very cheap and don't require a lot of expensive equipment to be able to implement.
You just mentioned that there was a scarcity of doctors. Is there all around a lack of sufficient education for potential healthcare practitioners?
Absolutely. It's very expensive to train a doctor, and interestingly, it is expensive to train a lab technician, but it's much cheaper than training a doctor. That's one thing. But a huge problem, actually, with health professionals all over Africa, not just doctors, this includes nurses, pharmacists, and a lot of other health professionals, is the fact that when they are trained, the working conditions, and this is not just pay, although pay is part of it, the working conditions are so poor for many of these health practitioners that they end up migrating. And so very often a doctor can be frustrated because he has learned in medical school how to make a diagnosis, and the tools for making that diagnosis are not available in the hospital that he's practicing in. Whereas there's a hospital somewhere else in the world where he can get any tool that he wants to be able to make precise diagnosis for his patients. And you can imagine such a doctor who's also underpaid thinking about, well, maybe I don't want to work here anymore. Maybe I can't work here anymore. And so the shortage of health professionals is in part due to the fact that Africa doesn't train enough of them today, but it's also due to the fact that many of those that are trained actually migrate. I think there are more Ghanaian doctors working in the U.S. than there are in Ghana, just to give you an example.
What would it take to actually put proper diagnostics in place?
A lot of different things. I mean, one of the more obvious ones is obviously, you know, somebody has to pay for these diagnostics. They are not cheap, but if they're used, they can actually be cost effective because they will actually save money in other areas. For example, if you have more precise diagnostics, they allow you to use cheaper drugs and less drugs. And so savings that are made in one area could be put into diagnostics. So obviously we need somebody to pay for them, but we also need the people who pay for healthcare in general to be aware that diagnostics should be on the list. Very often national governments and health ministries in Africa that make budgets for healthcare actually don't bother to budget for diagnostics. They just haven't thought about it. And very often donors that make vaccines and drugs and so on available to many developing countries, including countries in Africa, don't think that they also should be donating tools for using those drugs, which include diagnostics. So there's a change of thinking there that's important. The other thing is something that, you know, we talked about a bit earlier, which is the fact that for some conditions, the diagnostic tests that are available today are not ideal for using, say, in a small remote hospital, you know, somewhere in Africa that doesn't have a lab. What you'd like is more point-of-care tests that can be used by somebody who doesn't have medical or laboratory training. And the technology to invent those tests, as I said, exists. They'd be very similar to, you know, a home pregnancy test that's used here in the U.S. And that kind of test for an infectious disease that's very common in a part of Africa would be very, very valuable. And what we need is incentives for scientists and biotech companies to develop those types of tests and make them available to patients that need them.
So the reasons that you just mentioned, is that why you wrote this book?
Actually, it is. It was really important for me to write this. You know, some people ask me sometimes, you know, well, you know, why are you focusing on diagnostics? Isn't there also a shortage of medicines, a shortage of doctors, and so on? But I find that people are a bit more aware of the fact that there's a health professional shortage in Africa, or that there aren't enough drugs, or that there aren't enough vaccines. But the idea that diagnostic tests just aren't used enough seems to be something that somehow went under the radar. And so I wrote the book to sort of bring it to the attention of people who care about how healthcare is delivered in Africa. This is an important component. It's something that can be fixed, and it's something that should be fixed. And so, yes, this was an important motivator for writing the book.
Iruka Okeke is author of the book Divining Without Seeds, The Case for Strengthening Laboratory Medicine in Africa. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's been nice talking to you about this.